So today we're going to talk about yoga, particularly in the yoga sutras. Everyone should have a handout and be in sight of the text. Okay, so far then we've looked at the notion of liberation generally, and then we looked at Samkhya last week, and we're going to develop that idea of Samkhya in the Yoga Sutras today, and in yoga generally. And you've got different kinds of response. You've got liberation, this idea of liberation that I've discussed. And you have different responses to that, what it means and how it's attained. And generally you've got theistic responses, which claim that liberation is attained through grace, and partly through effort, or perhaps even purely through grace. And that's attested quite early on in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. You already get this idea of prasada, of grace, that you're liberated by the grace of a divine being. Then you get non-theistic traditions. The notion of liberation in non-theistic traditions, where liberation is attained through, generally through effort of detaching the self from the world of the senses, through meditation and asceticism, which leads to this state of knowledge or jnana. And there's some discussion about that. So Shankara, as we might get onto it, says that you actually can't attain liberation through meditation or yoga, because that's action, and so nothing you can do can get you liberated, because liberation is knowledge, is a kind of cognition. But generally, non-theistic traditions emphasize sustained effort, and these methods are generally be known as yoga. So I thought today we'd first of all look at the concept of yoga, then look at a brief textual history, and then look at Patanjali's opening sutras regarding his definition of yoga. So the concept of yoga, it comes from the Sanskrit root yuj, which means to yoke, which is cognate with our word yoke, indeed, to join together, or yoke, unite. So it has the implication of a yoke, like two cattle or something harnessed, the thing which harnesses two cattle to kind of control them. And possibly the idea of joining together, are both kind of implications of control and uniting. And it came to be, the word yoga comes to designate a practice designed to control the senses and the mind in order to transcend the ego, the ahankara, the eye-maker that we saw in Samkhya last week, one of the tattvas. And you could say that yoga in general contains the following ideas, which I've listed on the handout. That consciousness can be transformed through focusing attention on a single point. I can't do diacritical marks, I'm afraid, at the moment, but so ekagrata, one-pointedness. So through focusing on a single point and eliminating everything else, that changes the state of your mind, that changes the state of your consciousness through concentration. And this transformation of consciousness eradicates limiting mental constraints such as greed and hate. So the general model is that the mind is constantly wandering around all over the place, and it's that which causes the suffering. So through controlling the mind, through concentrating on a single point, that eradicates distractions and the fluctuations of the mind that keep somebody bound up in the world. So it facilitates detachment through concentration. And that concentrating on a single point eradicates the usual mental constraints which limit us and give us false identifications. So yoga is a discipline or range of disciplines constructed to facilitate the transformation of consciousness. And consciousness, now the word there is chitta. Chitta, consciousness, which is the process of being aware, determines the reality or world, being's experience. So there's a relationship between chitta and loka in these traditions. So as is the chitta, so is the loka. As is the consciousness, so is the world of experience. As in Buddhism, you get this very strong relationship between the two. So you change the chitta and you change the loka, you change the world of experience. Which means, quite radically in some of these yogic traditions, that you go into a state called samadhi, or higher awareness, in which you're no longer aware of the world. Or as in Buddhism, you go into these jhanas, these dhyanas, or absorptions, where you experience these higher levels of awareness, which are also worlds of experience. So you meet other beings who live in those worlds and you're in these absorbed states of consciousness. So you've got... The yoga tradition carries on that kind of Samkhya psychology, if you like, which links the structure of the cosmos with the structure of the mind. So you get that correlation again developed in the yoga traditions. A fifth characteristic of the concept of yoga is that consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects. That what you focus on, what you concentrate on, colours the mind. And consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects. Well, that's a Greek idea as well. The mind takes the form of its objects. So the implication there that there's always a subject and object to consciousness, and the nature of the subject seems to be determined by what it contemplates, by its objects of attention. So if you're really into going to the cinema or something, then that your mind takes on the qualities of that experience, of that object. Or you could be absorbed in a book or something, and the mind takes on the qualities of its objects. Whatever the mind is paying attention to, it takes on those qualities. And if it repeatedly pays attention to certain things, it takes on the qualities of those things more deeply. And these are called traces or grooves in consciousness, which result in future states of awareness. But we'll go into all this in a bit more detail in a minute. Okay, so those are arguably five features or characteristics of yoga generally. Now, the origins of yoga are slightly obscure. In the Indus Valley, you had these seals, if you remember, those seals that I spoke of, perhaps, or it may have been last term now. But the Indus Valley civilization was an urban culture with developed a sophisticated kind of civilization, which may have developed an alphabet, which has not yet been deciphered, but has these small seals, which you can see in the Ashmolean, actually, they've got one or two of them there, of figures apparently sitting in a yogic posture, and indeed they have one in the Ashmolean, which is very interesting. Possibly the god Shiva, or a prototype kind of Shiva. There's a big debate about this, whether this is just somebody sitting in a cross-legged position, or whether it's actually a yogi. It could be someone sitting, it could be a god in a cross-legged position. Asko Parpoda thinks it's not a yogi at all, thinks it's that this figure is actually a seated bull, because these seals are almost identical to Elamite seals that they found in Mesopotamia. So whether yoga does come from the Indus Valley is questionable, really. But certainly you get these Shramana traditions developing in the kind of the second urbanization, if you like, from 500 to 400 BC in the Ganges Plain, where you've got a surplus of wealth and you've got groups wandering around seeking this idea of liberation. And Buddhism and Jainism come out of that context, along with other groups such as the Ajivikas and lots of other ascetic groups seeking a liberation from the world of rebirth. And this Shramana ideology comes into the mainstream Brahmanical tradition. Now, where are they getting their yogic ideas of yoga from? And Eliade thinks that yoga is actually a very ancient and has its origins in shamanism. And he, I think he said that shramana may be cognate with shaman, and I'm a bit sceptical of that myself. I'd have to ask an Indo-European linguist, but certainly there are ideas within the shramana tradition which are not dissimilar to some shamanic practices or ecstatic practices of changing your state of awareness. and the belief that change state of awareness is somehow higher or better than the usual world of experience. Now, yoga in the text, it's absent from the Sanghitas, although in the Rig Veda you get a hymn to a figure called the Muni, the silent one, or a Keshin. And of course Shakyamuni is the name for the Buddha, the silent sage. So Muni is a word for a sage, a silent one, or Keshin, one with long hair. And this seems to portray, this hymn seems to portray a yogi type figure with magical powers flying through the air. It's quite a famous hymn, but it's a strange hymn. Sorry, I didn't bring it along, I should have done. I'll try and remember to bring it next time. And you have other groups attested in the Veda called the Vratyas, those who have taken a vow. And they wore an antelope skin and wandered around in small groups. They seem to be ascetic figures who had living in families, actually, but on the edges of Brahmanical society, who seem to practice tapas or asceticism in some sense. In the Brahmanas, you get an emphasis on tapas, the asceticism or heat, which is generated through ascetic practices such as fasting. And the yajamana, the person who performs the sacrifice, has to undergo austerity before the sacrifice begins, sitting in a hut, fasting with his wife, for example, and producing this tapas, this inner heat. And that's again attested in the Upanishads, where you get tapas heat associated with power and practices of asceticism, generating great heat within the body and also generating great power. Now, in the Upanishads, the idea of yoga comes to the fore. Even though the word isn't used until the Katha Upanishad, you get the Brihadaranyaka talking about yoga. And that passage, if you can have a look at that first section there. What page does your handout begin? That loose page that I handed around. What's the first page of the...
I don't have the loose one.
Oh, the loose one.
4423 and 456.
456. Oh, well, if some of you haven't got the whole thing, but if you turn to page 456, page 127, the text has spoken about the self. On the previous page, on page 125, it says, about this self, one can only say not, not, neti, neti. One can only say not, not, I, the self is not this and not that. He is ungraspable, for he cannot be grasped. He is undecaying, for he is not subject to decay. He has nothing sticking to him, for he does not stick to anything. He is not bound, yet he neither trembles in fear nor suffers injury. So the goal is to achieve or realize this self, of which nothing can be said, although it does say that that the self is ungraspable, undecaying, and so on. These two thoughts do not pass across this self at all. Therefore, I did something bad, and therefore I did something good. The self, on the other hand, passes across both those, but he is not burned by anything that he has done or left undone. And then it says that the same point is made in the Rig Vedic verses. And then it goes on to discuss the nature of the self. So the self is beyond moral action. The self is detached in its essence, is beyond action in the world, is beyond good acts or bad acts. It's like the Samkhya Purusha, which is not attached, not affected by Prakriti. But in distinction to the Samkhya Purusha, this self is unified, is at one with this absolute power of Brahman in this text. So a man who knows this, therefore, on page 127, a man who knows this about the detached true nature of the self, therefore becomes calm, composed, cool, patient, and collected. He sees the self in just himself and all things as the self. Evil does not pass across him, and he passes across all evil. He is not burned by evil. He burns up all evil. That's papa, sin or evil or something like that. He becomes a Brahmin, free from evil, free from stain, free from doubt. He is the world of Brahman, Your Majesty, and I have taken you to him, so said Yajnavalkya. So you get the idea there that through becoming calm, composed, cool, patient, and collected, you see the self in the self, this essence of the self within the self, within yourself. Well, Atman can just be a reflexive pronoun, but it also has this substantive connotation in these texts as the essence of a person. So you see the self in yourself, in oneself, Atman. And that's a true Brahmin. Or just that last verse at 24. Now, this is the immense and unborn self, the eater of food and the giver of wealth. The man who knows this finds wealth. And this is the immense and unborn self, unaging, undying, immortal, free from fear, the Brahman. Brahman surely is free from fear. And a man who knows this undoubtedly becomes Brahman, that is free from fear. So knowledge gives you liberation. Knowledge that you are that absolute gives you liberation. So that's an early indication of yogic type ideas, although it doesn't mention the word. The Katra Upanishad next. In the next page of the handout there. Oh yes, this is the story of Nachiketa's death. Nachiketa's is the son of a sage who annoys his father. And his father sends him to death. He says, "Father, to whom will you give me?" He repeated it a second time and a third time, and the father yelled at him, "I'll give you to death." So the father, having said that to the son, "I'll give you to death," he then goes to the realm of death. The son goes to the realm of death and sitting there waiting at the door to be let in by death. But death is out, death is away, and death comes back 3 days later or something, and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry for keeping you waiting." It's kind of ironic, really. He says, "For keeping you waiting, I'll grant you three wishes, three boons." And Nachiketa says, "Okay, the first wish, then I want to be returned to my father." So he goes back. He says, "Okay, you can go back to your dad." The second wish is he wants to know the fruits of sacrifice. The fruits of sacrifice are going to heaven. And the third wish he wants to know is how to gain immortality and how to conquer death. And death, of course, doesn't want to tell him how to conquer death. So, but he does, he persists, and in the end, death tells him. And this is how you conquer death, through through this practice of this inner practice. Which page does your text start on there? 387 or
3.11.
3.11. Oh yeah, okay, so yeah. Oh yeah, and you conquer death through knowing the self and the true nature of the self as immortal. And how do you do that? You do that through controlling the self. And here we have this famous image of a chariot, which occurs later in the Gita, and also you get it in Buddhism. I think the Buddhist image might be picking up from this, from a general image, but the Buddhists reinterpret this. So you've got there, verse 3, know the self as the rider in a chariot, and the body as simply the chariot. Know the intellect as the charioteer, that's the buddhi. Know the mind as simply the reins. The senses, they say, are the horses. The sense objects are the paths around them. He who is linked to the body, senses and mind, the wise proclaim as the one who enjoys. When a man lacks understanding and his mind is never controlled, his senses do not obey him, as bad horses do not obey a charioteer. But when a man has understanding and his mind is ever controlled, his senses obey him, as good horses and charioteer. When a man lacks understanding, is unmindful and always impure, he does not reach the final step, but gets on in the round of rebirth. But when a man has understanding, is mindful and always pure, he does reach the final step, from which he is not reborn again. When a man's mind is his reins, intellect is charioteer, he reaches the end of the road, that highest step of Vishnu. Higher than the senses are their objects, higher than the sense objects is the mind, higher than the mind is the intellect, higher than the intellect is the immense self. Higher than the immense self is the unmanifest. Higher than the unmanifest is the person, the Purusha. Higher than the person, there is nothing at all. That is the goal. That is the highest state. I don't know if you've got the next page.
No.
You haven't, okay. So there we are, that inner self that you're supposed to realise. And you can see the Samkhya influence here. It's all... All this terminology is Samkhya, although it's not the Samkhya philosophy, philosophical system, but it's a terminology which gets codified into the Samkhya system. It is all here. The implication is, if you practice yoga, then you transcend death. You defeat yama. So in that story of Nachiketas and Shweta Keti, you've got some interesting tensions. You've got the affirmation of the worldly Brahmanical life, and he wants to go back to his father, and he wants to practice sacrifice to lead to the world of heaven. But there's this third wish, this third desire coming in to transcend death, to go beyond death, and by implication to go beyond the world, the Brahmanical world of sacrifice and filial piety. Now by the time we get to the Shvetashvatara of Upanishad, the whole thing is really in full bloom, as it were. And here we've got two 8 to 14. Have I given you page to Adhyaya 2 in the Shvetashvatara?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Chapter 2. Yoking first his mind and extending then his thoughts, Savitri, having recognized the fire as the light, brought it here from the earth. Oh, it's like the English doesn't sound quite right to me. But this is important. With minds yoked, we make the offering under the stimulus of the god Savitri, that's the sun, for the heavenly abode, for strength. Yoking the gods, as they go to heaven with their mind and to the firmament with their thought, may Savitri stimulate them to create the lofty light. They yoke their minds, they yoke their thoughts. And this is the Yuj. Those inspired poets of the lofty poet. But one who knows the pattern has apportioned the offerings. That one alone, who knows the patterns, has apportioned the offerings. Resounding is the praise of the god Savitri. So here you've got the notion of yoga linked to the notion of sacrifice, and it's a reinterpretation of the offerings. So it's knowledge rather than the actual patterning of the making the offerings that's important. I don't want to go forward, I don't think. Yeah, at verse 8, you've got a classic kind of formulation of yoga. When he keeps his body straight with the three sections erect and draws the senses together with the mind into his heart, the wise man shall cross all the frightful rivers with the boat consisting of that formulation, Brahman. So, again, an image shared in Buddhism, that you cross the ocean of suffering in the raft of the boat of Dharma. So you cross over the fearful ocean of samsara, rebirth, in the through yoga. Compressing his breaths in here and curbing his movements, the man should exhale through one nostril when his breath is exhausted. A man should keep in his mind diligently under a man should keep his mind diligently vigilantly under control, just as he would that wagon yoked to unruly horses. Again, the same image of the chariot, and the same word rata. So here you've got simple, an early form of pranayama, breath control. You control the breath. You've got one nostril and breathe in through that one, block the other one and breathe in through that one. So this is very early for those kinds of practices to bear witness to those kinds of practices. Level and clean, free from gravel, fire and sand, near noiseless running waters and the like, pleasing to the mind but not offensive to the eye, provided with a cave or a nook sheltered from the wind. In such a spot, one should engage in yogic practice. A nice clean place, and you're doing yoga. This is an interesting verse. Mist, smoke, sun, fire, wind, fireflies, lightning, crystal, and moon. These are the apparitions that, within the yogic practice, precede and pave the way for the full manifestation of Brahman. So in this inner, interior practice, you're sitting there with your eyes shut, doing your pranayama, and you have these kind of inner visions arising within you that are presages towards this revelation of the light of the absolute. When earth, water, fire, air, and ether, akasha, have arisen together, and the body, made up of the fires, becomes equipped with the attributes of yoga, that man, obtaining a body tempered by the fire of yoga, or cooked in the fire of yoga, will no longer experience sickness, old age, or suffering. Lightness, health, the absence of greed, a bright complexion, a pleasant voice, a sweet smell, very little feces or urine, that, they say, is the first working of yogic practice. Just as a disc smeared with clay, once it's cleaned well, shines brightly, so also an embodied person, once he has perceived the true nature of the self through yoga, becomes solitary, his goal attained and free from sorrow. When, by means of the true nature of the self, which resembles a lamp, a man practicing yoga, yogic restraint, sees here the true nature of Brahman, he is freed from all fetters, because he has known God, unborn, unchanging, and unsullied by all objects. So a very succinct encapsulation of yoga, which could actually characterize all the later traditions, the understanding of the later traditions as well. Lastly, you've got the Maitri Upanishad there. On the next. I may not have done that.
No,
never mind. Well, in the Maitri Upanishad, you have six limbed yoga, which talks about breath control, withdrawal of the senses, meditation, concentration. I'll be coming on to that in a minute. I need to mention the Bhagavad Gita chapter 6, where you have, which is devoted to yoga in a more sort of ordinary sense of this kind of sense. And you get Yoga Upanishads from about 100 BC to 300 CE, which are pretty early texts really, which speak about breath control, speak about inner vision, this journey, this inner journey that leads you to the absolute, to the Brahman, the solitary journey. It's a bit like Plotinus, the journey of the alone to the alone. It's that kind of idea. Through this inner solitary quest, you reach liberation, which is a path. And on that path, you encounter these various inner visions. And particularly important in the Yoga Upanishads, you get this idea of inner sound, nada or shabda, which becomes particularly important in medieval Hindu traditions of Shabda Yoga, Nada Yoga, that it links in with the notion of mantra as well, that the Lord resonates in the body as a sound, which through the practice of blocking off your senses, you can, I can't do it, but you hear, shut your eyes, stick your fingers in your ears and your eyes and your nose, and you hear the inner, concentrate on the inner Shabda, on the inner sound. And through the self attaching itself to the inner sound, it raises the self from out of the body to the absolute. That's the idea. The soul residing in the heart is extracted from the body through the crown of the head to the absolute, through being attached to the sound of the Lord, the Shabda, the Nada. And this, and the Yoga Tattva Upanishad mentions four kinds of yoga: mantra yoga, repetition mantras, laya yoga, Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga. Now, Laya Yoga means disillusion. And it's the disillusion, really, mantra and Laya are very similar. It's the disillusion of the self into the absolute. Hatha means force or violence. Hatha Yoga, which becomes very important and very popular in the West later on. It's the yoga of force, the yoga of extreme physical force in order to control, ultimately control the mind. And Raja Yoga, the kingly or the best yoga, which is Patanjali's yoga, as we'll see. The Hatha Yoga, the text there, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, is in the 15th century Svatmarama's text, which becomes particularly influential. And the kind of yoga that you get in, you know, throughout the country on church halls and stuff is based on Hatha Yoga. So most people will think of yoga, they'll think of Hatha Yoga. But the key text, the yoga becomes not just as a method, but becomes a system of philosophy, along with Samkhya. And Patanjali systematized yoga in the Yoga Sutras, which is composed between 100 BC and 500 CE. There are several versions of the text around. My own, one of my own favourites is Hariharananda Aranya's version of it, which he's a Samkhya. He was dead now, but he was a Samkhya pundit, so he's versed in the Samkhya school. Usually, you get interpretations of the Yoga Sutras based on Vedanta or based on Advaita or Monism, but that's not the metaphysical tradition behind yoga. It's in fact Samkhya dualism. And Swami Hariharananda Aranya is indeed a Samkhya dualist, and so he reads the Yoga Sutras arguably in a truer spirit of their composition. And it has a commentary by Vyasa's commentary. And it presents this eight-limbed yoga, this eight-structured, eight-stranded yoga, the Raja Yoga, the king, or simply the best yoga. Raja just means the best, really, the best yoga. And represents a codification of knowledge, ideas, and practices that developed for many centuries. So we've seen here in the Shvetashvatara ideas several hundred years after the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, but you can see a continuity of ideas there. And again, couple of centuries probably after the Shvetashvatara, you've got the Yoga Sutras codifying these kinds of ideas about yogic practice. And the summary of yoga, in essence, I suppose, can be summarized in the first four or five Yoga Sutras. So, Atta Yoga Anushasana, now the teaching about yoga. And this is probably the most important verse next in the whole text, I should think, that yoga, what is yoga? Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. Yogash chittavritti nirodha. So, I got it.
Yeah, I'll write it up. Yoga Shitapiti. Yoga. So what is yoga? Yoga is yoga, which is a normative singular subject, is the chittavritti. Nirodha is the nirodha, the cessation of the vritti, the turning of the chitta, of the consciousness. The stopping, the cessation, the fluctuations of consciousness, vritti, from vrit to turn, the whirlings of the mind. So it's the cessation of the whirling mind. Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. Otherwise, at verse 1-3, there is conformity to the fluctuations. Vritti sarupyam itarantra. Otherwise, there's sarupyam, conformity to the chitta vrittis, to the vrittis. So, if you don't do that, if you don't stop the mental fluctuations, there's conformity to the fluctuations, i.e., the mind takes on the forms of its objects. If you don't stop the mind from fluctuating, then the mind goes with the vrittis, goes with the fluctuations. So, very succinct. Those two verses, extremely succinct teachings of the essence of yoga, really. He then goes on to develop and elaborate what the fluctuations are. He says there are five kinds of fluctuations tending towards harm or non-harm, klishta or aklishta. So you've got the fluctuations of the mind tend towards harm or non-harm, but really you want to stop them, even if they go to non-harm or good. Even that keeps you trapped. So you've got to transcend even the fluctuations which are apparently good. And they are value cognition, misconception, conceptualization, sleep and memory. This is Patanjali's analysis of the fluctuations, these five kinds of fluctuations, which keep you bound. It's interesting that sleep and memory are there as well. So sleep, memory, you know, you're falling asleep all the time when you're doing your yoga practice. Or your memories from the past keep coming up and stopping the concentration on a single point. And it's interesting that valid cognition is part of the vrittis, that's the usual means, the pramanas, the usual means of knowing the world. We haven't got time, I'm afraid, to go into all this now, but he develops an eight-limbed system of yoga, Ashtanga yoga. You had a six-limbed yoga in the Maitreya Upanishad. Roll forward a couple of hundred years and you've got this eight-limbed yoga having developed, which is ethics, which is non-violence, telling the truth, not stealing, ahimsa, celibacy, not being greedy, discipline, cleanliness, serenity, tapas, austerity, study or recitation of the Veda, and devotion to the Lord. That's important in yoga, devotion to the Lord. And these cleanliness, serenity, these cleanliness practices, shaucha, that's all you see these yogis swallowing cloths and sticking things up their noses and so on. That's shaucha. I was once in Vienna actually talking to a yogi, or he said he was a yogi anyway, but in a cafe, in a bar, and he said, "I can drink a pint of water through my nose." He then proceeded to do it. I said, "I bet you can't do it with a pint of lager." I said, but anyway, so yogic power, demonstration of yogic power. But having got that ethical base, you can then develop posture, which is asana, which is cognate with the English, I think. That on which you sit, breath control, pranayama, sense withdrawal. So you get into posture, asana, you then control the breath, you then withdraw the senses, as the tortoise withdraws itself into its shell. Having done that, you get these three levels of concentration, the concentration, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. You could actually translate them all: concentration, concentration, and concentration. But concentration, dharana, meditation, dhyana, or absorption, same as the Buddhist word, and samadhi. And samadhi is of two kinds, with support of the objects of consciousness and without support. I don't, as it's too complex to go into now for 5 minutes, but you've got this terminology of initial thought, sustained thought, joy, and the sense of I. Apart from the sense of I, all that terminology comes from early Buddhism, from where you have you're concentrating on an object, and the initial thought is throwing the mind onto the object of concentration. So you just think of a green apple. I mean, we all think of a green apple. Okay, that's it. That's vitarka, throwing the mind onto the object, and try and keep thinking of the green apple. And that's vichara. And examine, is it all green, or is there bits of red in it, or is it, you know, has it got a leaf attached to it? That's vichara, the examining of the object. And those two occur in early Buddhism. So all practice is you've got this initial thought, throwing the mind onto the object and keeping it there, sustained thought, that's vichara. But because of the vrittis, the mind moves off all the time, so you've got to keep throwing it back. So these processes occur all the time. Now, once you've established vitaka and vichara, you can keep the mind on the object. That leads to joy, ananda. Now in Buddhism, that's piti, or joy arises, or harsha, which is goose pimples. And then that's accompanied by a sense of I. Now that's absent from the Buddhist tradition, of course, because they reject any notion of a self. But here, in the yogic tradition, that's accompanied by a sense of I-ness, asmita, asmi, I am-ness. Then having established concentration, you can then transcend even any support of concentration into this state called asampragnyata samadhi. And it's in that last state that the Lord appears to you, according to Vijnana Bhikshu, a 16th century commentator on the Yoga Sutras. So the Lord appears in this last stage. Finally, magical powers. There's a whole book. Book 3 of the Yoga Sutras is dedicated to magical powers such as levitation, walking water, passing through walls, and all that, telepathy, that kind of thing. Knowledge of power over the elements, power to create, to fulfil all desires. These are the same as the Buddhist lists as well. And liberation is eventually attained from asampragnyata samadhi, which is Kaivalya, which is our old friend Kaivalya from the Samkhya metaphysics. So the metaphysics behind yoga is dualist. The self, we're all separate selves, we're all separate from each other. Liberation is separation from matter, from prakriti, absorption in the Kaivalya. And you do that through, not through the grace of the Lord, but you see the Lord on your way to that solitary state. Now the Lord is just another Ishvara like you, and is an object of contemplation, but he's a special kind of Purusha. So you become like Ishvara at liberation, but you don't become one with Ishvara because you're numerically distinct. And he's a special Purusha because he was never touched by affliction, action, the results of action, or latent impressions. And he has no bondage. And then, how do we know about Ishvara? Vyas says, through the scriptures, through Shruti. And scripture is the proof. And then, to this question, what's the proof of scripture? He says, wisdom. Pragna, supreme wisdom, is the proof of scripture. So here, it's interesting, you've got from Samkhya, atheistic Samkhya, dualistic metaphysics, you have a theistic yoga that adopts the Samkhya metaphysics but as the Lord. But here the Lord is hardly, is not the creator God, but is just a special kind of Ishvara who is an object of meditation. Now how Ishvara got in there is difficult to say. Yoga doesn't need Ishvara in order for the system to work. But nevertheless, Ishvara is there. Now Eliade comes along and says, well, that's because Ishvara is a phenomenological experience that these yogis are having. They're encountering this transcendent Lord in their meditation, and so he gets incorporated into the system. Could be, well, who knows, that's a theological claim. So yoga then is a separate system of philosophy, and partly coming out of Samkhya and these early speculations, and pervades the rest of Hindu systems of soteriology, but gets reinterpreted by Shankara. Shankara writes a commentary on Yoga Sutras, claiming yoga away from a dualist metaphysics into his own monistic Advaita model. I mean, why write a commentary on a text, and yes, you want to. say that it's say the opposite of what it says in a sense, or claim it for your own. And that's what he does. And then later yoga gets very much linked with the Advaita tradition, although in its origin, in Yoga Sutras, it's clearly dualist in its metaphysics. Any questions or points before we wind up? Was this is this all ABC to you? Do you know all this? No. Okay. Good. No, oh, no, shut up. No questions, points. Okay, then we'll just carry on next week.